from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Amandine Lee.
This week on War News Radio, Stop and Go. We first learn about Afghanistan's transportation industry.
The Afghan leadership always feared if they allowed either the Russians coming from the north or the British from India in the south to build a railway across the border, one way or another, it would end up with Afghanistan being annexed to either the Russian or British empires.
Then, we hear about the Afghan system of microfinance.
We want to, in every case, only help the client with a loan or a financial service in which we provide them an increase in their ability to produce income for their family.
But first, a roundup of this week's news, with a special report on Occupy Wall Street.
The Arab League decided in an emergency session to suspend Syria's membership in response to the government's refusal to stop violent crackdowns on civilian protesters. Syria agreed to an earlier peace plan outlined by the Arab League on November 2nd, but has since failed to end the violence. In the 8 months since the protests started, Human Rights Watch has estimated that over 3,500 civilians and 1,500 security force members have been killed. If Syria fails to stop the violent crackdowns, it may face sanctions from individual Arab League member states as well. The League also plans to send observers on a mission meant to ensure that Syria upholds the terms of the peace plan.
The Free Syria Army, a group of defectors from Syrian security forces, attacked multiple military installations around Damascus. The largest assault occurred when the group fired rocket-propelled grenades on a compound of the Air Force Intelligence Directorate, a security branch that dissidents claim is responsible for the suppression of anti-government protesters. Although the Free Syria Army is thought to consist of only a few thousand defectors, the high-profile attack suggests that the group is gaining momentum.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai addressed the Loya Jirga, the traditional Afghan advisory council, outlining the details of a strategic partnership with the United States. The plan would give the U.S. permission to establish military facilities in Afghanistan, but would ask the United States to respect Afghanistan's national sovereignty. Specifically, Karzai called for an end to night raids by U.S. military forces on Afghan households, a tactic that Americans claim to be effective in combating the Taliban. In his speech, Karzai tried to convince his domestic audience that a foreign presence can coexist with Afghan nationalism, repeatedly referring to Afghanistan as a lion that could set the long-term details of its partnership with the U.S.
The International Monetary Fund has pledged a three-year, $133.6 million loan for Afghanistan after previously suspending credit to the country over 1 year ago. The IMF has allotted the new line of credit after observing Afghanistan's efforts to solve governing and accountability problems, which first became apparent during a fraud scandal at Kabul Bank. The bank collapsed, causing initial losses of $900 million, and is now under government control. The loan is intended to help with the transition after international military forces withdraw from the country. Afghanistan will receive an initial disbursement from the IMF of about $18.9 million.
More than 4.3 million Tunisians, about 52% of the population, voted in Tunisia's historic Constituent Assembly election this week. Ennahda, the country's moderate Islamic party, won the most seats in the new assembly, with 89 out of 217. Meanwhile, the Congress for the Republic, CPR, came in second, winning 29 seats. Together, Ennahda and CPR elected Moncef Marzouki, a veteran human rights activist, as the country's interim president. Together, Ennahda and CPR elected Moncef Marzouki, a veteran human rights activist, as the country's interim president. Marzouki, a physician and current head of the CPR, will hold the role during the creation of the new constitution by the assembly next year. Marzouki previously led the Tunisian League of Human Rights. In 1994, he was jailed after attempting to run for the presidency against former ruler and dictator Zayn al-Abidine Ben Ali, who was ousted after protests throughout the country in January.
Three French aid workers have been released in Yemen after being held hostage for almost 6 months. The workers, from the French charity Triangle Generation Humanitaire, were captured in May by al-Qaeda-linked militants demanding $12 million in ransom. According to a Yemeni tribal mediator, the hostages were freed when the government of neighboring Oman and a Yemeni businessman paid a ransom of an undisclosed amount. French President Nicolas Sarkozy issued a statement specifically thanking the Sultan of Oman for his work mediating the crisis, but the French government denied any involvement in paying the ransom.
New York City police arrested 140 demonstrators from Zuccotti Park, nearly 2 months after Occupy Wall Street protesters launched the encampment in September. The surprise raid in New York came one day after police arrested 33 demonstrators in Oakland, California. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg defended the sweep as a means to address growing health and safety concerns. In addition, State Supreme Court Justice Michael D. Stallman ruled against the demonstrators' claim of First Amendment rights on privately owned land. Demonstrators were allowed to return to the park 16 hours later, but only without sleeping gear.
Iran is dismissing a recent report by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the nuclear proliferation watchdog of the United Nations, warning about Iran's nuclear weapons capabilities. Iran attacked the report, which details extensive research that has advanced Iran's nuclear weapons program, for being politically motivated and based on false information. Despite Iran's claim that the programs are focused on research and energy, nations including the United States, Israel, and members of the European Union and the Gulf states intend to increase pressures on Iran. The IAEA's General Yukiya Amano is awaiting response to the request for a high-level mission to Iran. Though no formal punitive measures have been addressed in the IAEA resolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, warned that a military strike on Iran will be met with strong consequences.
This is War News Radio. Protesters returned to Zuccotti Park after being evacuated by New York City police. This comes days before the Occupy Wall Street movement's two-month anniversary. Max Nesterak has more.
Open the gates! Open the gates! Open the gates!
Occupy Wall Street protesters chanted to be let back into Zuccotti Park after New York City police cleared the space for cleaning this past week. Police arrested 200 demonstrators from the park and surrounding streets, nearly 2 months after protests began. The city decided to clear Zuccotti Park of protesters, citing laws governing public use of the park. As New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg explained,
"The law that created Zuccotti Park required that it be open for the public to enjoy for passive recreation 24 hours a day. Ever since the occupation began, that law has not been complied with, as the park has been taken over by protesters, making it unavailable to anyone else."
Bloomberg also supported the removal of demonstrators for public health and safety reasons.
"From the beginning, I've said that the city has two principal goals: guaranteeing public health and safety and guaranteeing the protesters' First Amendment rights. But when those two goals clash, the health and safety of the public and our first responders must be the priority."
Reporters were removed from the park prior to the raid and prevented from interviewing protesters. Mayor Bloomberg supported the police's decision to keep journalists away from the park, citing safety concerns. According to tweets from reporters on the scene, when some journalists returned to the area, police failed to distinguish between protesters and journalists. Among those arrested this week were seven journalists, including reporters from the Associated Press and a freelancer for National Public Radio. In addition, State Supreme Court Justice Michael D. Stallman ruled against the demonstrators' claim of First Amendment rights on privately owned land. Demonstrators were allowed to return to the park 16 hours later, but only without sleeping gear. For War News Radio, I'm Max Nesterak.
This is War News Radio. Afghanistan is at the crossroads of Central Asia, between East and South Asia, the Middle East, Russia, and Europe, and was an important stop on the Silk Road. War News Radio's Jared Nolan uses historical perspective and geographical location to define Afghanistan's current transportation industry and determine what the future holds. This is part of War News Radio's ongoing series on the state of the Afghan economy.
If you look at a map of Afghanistan, You might notice the outline of the country is shaped something like a lamb chop. What would be the bone extends to the northeast until it reaches China, where the two countries share a 47-mile border. This narrow strip of land between Tajikistan and Pakistan, 140 miles long but sometimes just 10 miles wide, reaches the end of the Himalayan range and is known as the Wakhan Corridor. So why is it there?
In the early 1870s, the reason the British wanted to do this was in order to set up a buffer state between them, between the British Empire in South Asia and the Russian Empire in Central Asia, because the Russians had kept moving south through Central Asia.
That was Dr. Brian Spooner, professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania and curator for Near Eastern Ethnology at the Penn Museum. But why does this territory extend all the way to China?
So the Wakhan Corridor was the tail end of that definition of boundaries in order to make absolutely sure that the British and the Russian empires didn't share a border.
The whole strategic rivalry between the British and Russian empires in Central Asia is known as the Great Game, and Afghanistan was at its center. As a buffer state, Afghanistan was completely isolated from the rest of the world, and no one interfered in the country's affairs. So Afghanistan remained independent, but it also remained undeveloped and has continued to feel the repercussions of the Great Game to this day. The deficient transportation infrastructure in Afghanistan is a clear example. Spooner explains how it started.
Well, because the Afghanistan was never under a colonial administration, and therefore there was no colonial administration to build an infrastructure as there was in India and the part of India that has become Pakistan and the part of Central Asia that became part of the Russian Empire.
Afghans also actively resisted the infrastructure. Amir Abdul Rahman, ruler of Afghanistan from 1880 to 1901, called the British railway that extended to the border of Afghanistan a knife pushed to my vitals, and vowed that there will be a railway in Afghanistan when the Afghans are able to make it themselves.
Again, that's very unusual because most countries are quite keen to have railways. But the Afghan leadership always feared if they allowed either the Russians coming from the north or the British from India in the south to build a railway across the border, one way or another, it would end up with Afghanistan being annexed to either the Russian or British empires.
That was Andrew Grantham, news editor of the trade magazine Railway Gazette International. Just this year, Afghanistan's first railway was completed. It runs from the Uzbekistan border in the north, 45 miles down to Mazar-i-Sharif, one of Afghanistan's main cities. There are a number of plans in the works to expand on this modest start, but many obstacles are in the way. One of them is the question of rail gauges, or the distance between the rails. As a testament to its location as a crossroads of Asia, three different rail gauges meet at Afghanistan. Iran to the west and China to the east use standard gauge, 4'8.5". The former Soviet Union republics to the north use Russian gauge, 5', and Pakistan and India to the south use broad gauge, 5'6".
At the moment, it's not really a problem. If it does develop a serious railway network, it will become a major problem once the rail networks meet up. And I think the choice of gauge for Afghanistan will have to depend on how people see the freight flows going.
Right now, there's no freight flowing, but policymakers are working to change that. The buzzword being thrown around by experts and government officials is the Modern Silk Road Initiative. Half a millennium ago, Afghanistan was a major stop along the old Silk Road until the trade route that linked Asia to Africa and the Mediterranean disintegrated. The idea now is to reconnect Afghanistan to the rest of the region and use its central location to spur development. Dr. Andrew Cutchins, director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, has studied the potential of this strategy.
So it's, to some extent, yes, it is certainly the promotion and the facilitation of the export of Afghan products, you know, to the rest of the world. But just as much so, it's the vision of these transcontinental long trade routes from Beijing to Berlin, Mumbai to Moscow, that would hopefully include Afghanistan and so-called Greater Central Asia as part of it.
The idea is that trade flowing through Afghanistan will generate customs duties, a sustainable source of domestic revenue. The tariff income is already increasing and makes up a significant portion of the government's revenue. There are a few challenges, however. One is simply a lack of physical infrastructure, not enough railroads and poor road conditions. Security is another one. but it may not be as problematic as it sounds. Cutchin studied the flow of U.S. military supplies traveling without military protection from Pakistan into Afghanistan.
What was surprising for me to learn is that actually, you know, less than 1% of what we're bringing in is being lost, and that actually there's a lower loss rate than in some counties in New Jersey. Not to pick on New Jersey, but that's just one of the figures that they had. It's like, wow, that's sort of very counterintuitive.
Attacks on convoys are infrequent because Afghans and Pakistanis have an incentive to facilitate this trade. As long as they benefit from the trucks driving along their roads, they will support the transit trade. Cutchin says the biggest problem is a dearth of what he calls soft infrastructure, institutions and rule of law to coordinate trade between countries. Surveys in the region have found that excessive transit time is spent waiting at customs outposts, something Grantham thinks will discourage the use of Afghanistan as a transit hub.
It probably wouldn't be an ideal route for things like China to Europe because of the number of borders that would have to be crossed.
The more likely alternatives for transcontinental shipping are the Trans-Siberian Railroad, or a railroad across Kazakhstan that is currently under development. Afghanistan could, however, provide a route to the sea for the former Soviet Union republics of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan without going through Russia. Also, the Chinese need to find a way to transport ore from their copper mine in Afghanistan back to China. There's some dispute whether this will involve a railroad line.
The Afghans that seem to think the Chinese have committed to building it, the Chinese believe they're committed to studying it rather than actually going ahead and building it.
Like most of Afghanistan's future, the fate of this railway remains unclear. Whether the Silk Road Initiative succeeds or fails, Afghanistan is reconnecting to its neighbors as regional players vie for influence in the country. The competition between China, Iran, Pakistan, and India in Central Asia has been termed the new great game, and Afghanistan could emerge in a better position than the last time around. For War News Radio, I'm Jared Nolan.
This is War News Radio. Since it was conceptualized and implemented in Bangladesh in the 1970s, microfinance has been touted as a win-win process. Its premise is simple: sustainably providing microcredit and other financial services to the poor in developing nations. In this part of War News Radio's ongoing series on the state of the Afghan economy, Alan Zhao looks into the implementation of microcredit in poverty-stricken Afghanistan, arguably the most unfriendly business environment in the world.
Earlier this year, the Afghan microfinance sector reached the milestone of having lent $1 billion. The Afghan government currently reports a gross microloan portfolio totaling $120 million. For comparison, Afghanistan's commercial banking sector's gross loan portfolio is valued at $1.6 billion. But with 236,000 active Afghan borrowers, the microfinance sector lends to 12 times the number of commercial banking borrowers. Where does microfinance find this large client base?
To use a very cliché term, microfinance is for the unbankable. And that means the segment of the population that would normally not qualify for a loan from a commercial bank. Commercial banks are very conservative in their approach to lending. They normally do not lend in small amounts. They ask for usually for collateral. So this segment of the population, which in most countries is the largest segment of the population, still has credit needs or still needs financial services.
That was Katrine Fakiri, Managing Director of the Microfinance Investment Support Facility for Afghanistan. MISFA is the independent governing body of all Afghan microfinance institutions and was created by the government in 2003. David Payne is the Chief Executive Officer of Oxus Afghanistan, one of the largest microfinance institutions, or MFIs, in the country. Payne describes his organization's search process for clients.
Oxus looks for clients that have some type of economic activity. In the idea of self-employment. So you would be be looking for someone who has a small vegetable stand or someone who does handicraft, creates small things that are then sold.
Like any traditional bank, microfinance institutions look for clients who can profitably use the loan. However, Payne notes that there is a social welfare element as well.
This is the vital sticking point, is that we want to, in every case, only help the client with a loan or a financial service in which we provide them an increase in their ability to produce income for their family. And that way they obviously have the opportunity to have a social impact on their life by being able to put their children through better schooling and take them to hospital.
But microfinance is more than just giving out microloans. Payne gives an example of one essential financial service not yet offered in Afghanistan.
Currently, microfinance institutions are not deposit-taking institutions, and that make that transition hopefully near the end of 2012. And this will be another pivotal milestone for microfinance in Afghanistan, where we don't just go into communities and teach people how to capitalize their businesses and increase their income, but we teach them the basic fundamentals of savings.
Microfinance has grown tremendously in Afghanistan since its beginning in 2003. However, Fakiri concedes that the exact impact of microfinance is unknown.
Anybody who's worked in the microfinance sector will understand that the economic impact takes, both social and economic impact take a long time. And we have to track it very closely over a number of years to see, to scientifically quantify the impact.
Sogul Zond is a gender studies researcher at the Afghanistan Research and Evaluations Unit, located in Kabul. In her recently published research report on microfinance in Kabul, she discovered that the increased family income allowed for improved female social empowerment.
Before that, they would say, we were poor. Why? I mean, I had no reason to go out. But now I can take part in shopping. I have the money to go out. So in that case, it extended their mobility.
The majority of clients in Afghanistan are in fact women, making up 75% of all borrowers. The ability of women to obtain these loans, Fakiri states, has led to significant gains for women.
Talking to the female clients and doing a number of research studies, over and over, what we hear from clients are that female clients are that they feel empowered, they feel confident, and they feel respected by their families, husbands, by their neighbors, because they are able to bring in this money, this funding to the household.
However, Zahn suggests that this message of female empowerment is often lost on Afghan men.
A lot of men, you know, didn't really realize that it was a loan for women. They would say, yes, that's a loan for the family through our women.
Microfinance seems especially promising in comparison to Afghanistan's traditional banking system, which was shaken with the disappearance of nearly $1 billion from its largest commercial bank last year. Despite operating with a comparable amount of money, MFIs have not suffered from any scandals. Fakiri suspects this is the result of MFI's nonprofit status.
An MFI's goal is not to become profitable, to make money and pay out dividends to certain individuals. The goal is to reach out to as many poor people as possible in a sustainable and viable way. And if they do become profitable, which they should, and it's possible to do so, that money is reinvested back into the institution.
Payne echoes this belief.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the nonprofit side of it as much as the mentality we have. When we come to work, we don't come to work to get rich, but we come to work to serve others.
Despite its enormous growth, the Afghan microfinance industry is not yet financially sustainable. Fakiri attributes this to be more than just costs associated with security, but costs inherent to the nature of Afghanistan.
In an environment like this, with the costs being so high, the terrain being very difficult, the landscape, the population density in comparison to our neighbors is much lower. So it's going to take us a bit longer than what we anticipated to reach sustainability.
Zahn cautions against the excessive focus on MFI financial sustainability, arguing that very little is truly known about the social effects of microfinance in Afghanistan.
The way the achievement of microfinance, the way the success of the microfinance institutes are now evaluated is based on the disbursement rate and how many loans have been given and how much money has been, how much they have been able to get out of it. All numbers, all the social aspects, all the social effects are anecdotal. There has been no evaluation on really what has been done socially in terms of gender.
The drive for sustainability is especially pressing because of waning foreign interest. Fakiri argues that the withdrawal of foreign troops also means a funding loss.
When the troops leave, so the money does as well. So it's very important that these institutions be able to stand on their own two feet and be sustainable by 2013 so that they can continue providing financial services and not collapse because of lack of funding.
She also notes possible effects of U.S. military withdrawal planned for 2014 on the presence of MFIs in the most dangerous provinces.
Some MFIs have small programs and currently in provinces like Helmand and Kandahar and Erzgan. They're smaller programs. Of course, they cannot scale up very much, but they have a presence there. So if the troops left and those provinces became even more unstable, then most likely these MFIs will close their branches and leave.
But Payne does not rule out the possibility of a continued microfinance presence, regardless of the political situation.
One theory is that the lives of Afghans will go on no matter what happens in 2014, and they'll still the guy who has a small shop and he's got to sell goods to feed his family will still get up every morning and go and do his job and work and run his business and provide for his family. And if that all keeps happening, Oxus is not a politically connected organization, we'll probably keep operating whether things get better or worse.
In war-torn Afghanistan, microfinance is a rare success story, providing a key source of credit for the rural economy. But how the industry will survive both physically and financially in post-withdrawal Afghanistan remains to be seen. For War News Radio, I'm Alan Zhao.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to keep up with War News Radio between shows.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Eliana Biscard Church, Natalia Choi, Amy DiPiero, Sam Hirschman, Stuart Russell, Colin Smith, and Chloe Wittenberg. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Amandine Lee. Until next time, thanks for listening.